Evident Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth, and when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evident Footprints, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on bbsradio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I'll be with you for the next hour on this October the 29th on the West Coast, now October the 30th on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zone. I'd like to welcome also all those listening to us on Wind Talkers Radio Network around the world, and that's in the U.S., Canada, Central and South America, all over Europe, Asia, Russia, Australia, New Zealand, and many, many other places. I should mention Ireland as well, because they listen to the show religiously. But we're talking about unorganized religion. So before we bring on tonight's guest, most of you know who that's going to be. If this is your first time tuning in, you're in for a real treat. Before our guest comes on, we've been talking about visitors from other planets in our galaxy who are in the vicinity of our Earth. And I've been in touch with this group for some time. It's no surprise. We received two phone calls last year from General Jeremiah, who is our representative to the United Galactic Federation. And last night I read a message about how their ships travel and move into portals and basically travel across vast areas of space, defying time, if you will, and going to planets light years away in a matter of hours. And he also alluded to how he was picked by the Federation, and it so happens that he is engaged to marry the person that picked him out. She comes from the planet Balqui. I have photos of Balqui on my website. She's affectionately called Karen, though that's not her complete name. Her name's not important other than to identify her. She certainly knows who we mean when we say Karen. In the old days, one would call into a radio station and make a request and dedicate it to another person. And I thought, in light of what we're going to be talking about tonight with our guest, I might dedicate on behalf of General Jeremiah to his fiancée, Karen, a song sung by Mr. Eric Clapton. And so enjoy, folks. the world. Death goes out to Karen from General Jeremiah. And I can assure you that that's going to cause quite a ruckus on the Alliance mothership. With that, I want to invite back to tonight's show a scientist, inventor, author, lecturer, and teacher, and our resident science advisor on Evident Footprints, and a good friend of BBS Radio, my good friend, Jim Murray. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Don. It's great to be with you as usual. How are you doing this evening? You sound good.
Thank you. Well, you sound good, too. So I guess we're going to have a good show.
Well, I hope so.
On our past shows, Jim, we've been discussing consciousness. This whole year, we've been really discussing the mechanics of the universe and how we fit into it, how consciousness and information and frequencies flow. And we've gotten into the topic very deeply of power production, the works of Nikola Tesla, Victor Schauberger, Wilhelm Reich, Royal Rife, many scientists who made fantastic discoveries that would have propelled life on Earth at least 1,000 years in advance of what it is today. And I mean, to be experienced by everyone on the planet, not just a few psychopaths. And tonight we determined that we were going to talk about your specific work. We've been talking about everyone else's work, and you have some inventions. You are working on some new projects, and you certainly have a handle on what could change the world in terms of power production and the really primitive use of energy the way it is right now. What you're doing is going to transcend that. And I'd like you to talk about that tonight and share that with the listening audience. I'm sure they're going to find it fascinating. And please, I hope you intend to include the story about the dual synchronous capacitor that you fired up during the Christmas season many years ago up in Michigan.
Well, I have no choice but to include that because, quite honestly, that was the start of the whole thing.
Okay.
At least from a practical point of view.
Yes. Okay.
So, okay, well, where we left off just about takes us to that point. We were talking last week about this character, Warren Goetz, and the vortex demonstration that he gave. And quite honestly, what happened after that, it can be summed up very briefly. I decided to stay in Detour, Michigan, not only because I was still interested in finding out the connection between Warren Goetz and Otis Carr, but also because it's really a beautiful little town, and the people I found to be very charming and very accepting, despite all of the comments from Mr. Goetz. And what happened was totally serendipitous, if you believe in such things. There was a gentleman who was the foreman, the electrical foreman, over at the quarry on Drummond Island. And he made a very terrible mistake and decided to engage in a snowmobile race while under the influence. I won't mention his name just in case, you know, there are still people who remember him. But unfortunately, in the condition he was in, that wasn't a good thing to do. And he wound up passing between two trees that were very close together and tore both his legs off. And he bled to death in the snow before they found him. And, of course, word of that problem got around very quickly, and my friend Vern Conkle, who was one of the people I met up there in the village, made a very strong suggestion that I should go over right away and put in an application as a potential replacement for this gentleman as electrical foreman. And I did that. To be quite honest, I didn't think I had a prayer at getting the job, but lo and behold, within a couple of weeks, I was invited over for an interview, and they actually gave me the position. So that spring, I began a seven-year stretch with Bethlehem Steel, who owned that facility. And one of the first things that we had a meeting about was the condition of the island's power grid and all of the associated pieces of equipment. And so I did a tour all around the place and made several suggestions as to what could be done to improve the overall efficiency of the place. They were really concerned about their power bill. That was the biggest thing. And they had, I believe, at that time, four electric shovels. Now, these were pretty huge machines, and two of them were Harnischweger, or P&H as they're called, digging machines, and they were carried on cables, and they were fairly new. The other one, I don't remember anymore what the company name was, but the oldest machine that they had was built by General Electric, and I think it was a Bucyrus Erie. And they were going to scrap that because it was reaching the end of its rope. And I was pretty familiar with the equipment that was on board there, and I said to them, listen, you can scrap the shovel, but I want the guts. And so I, in my spare time, my crew and I stripped out the power pack that runs this thing, which was essentially a large synchronous AC motor attached to three different generators and all the associated high voltage controls. And we brought they brought all that equipment into the electrical shop, and we started to revamp it. And my intention was to build them a device that I had always wanted to experiment with and save them some realistic amount of power in the process, but also get to the position where I could experiment with some really unusual situations. And it took me 3 years in my spare time to build this thing. They actually allowed me to put up a building and everything else. And essentially what I was doing was transforming the equipment that used to run that electric shovel into a large synchronous capacitor with some very special control features that they don't normally have. And I won't go into what they are because that's still proprietary. But at any rate, we built this thing and put it online. And the thing that was most evident immediately was that at the end of the month, the first month of its running, not only did they get a bill which was significantly less, it was about 30% less than what they normally had to pay out, but that bill was followed shortly by a group of individuals from the local power company who were sent over to inspect all of the metering equipment, because they figured that we had to have bypassed the meters in order to reduce the bill by that much, which I thought was kind of a veiled compliment. But anyway, they didn't find anything wrong with their meters, and I very proudly showed them the synchronous capacitor and explained how it operated, and they went away in amazement. And from that day on, basically what I did was I started concentrating on actually studying various effects associated with the use of this device. And I installed, all kinds of metering and a terminal for an oscilloscope and a chart recorder and all kinds of stuff to monitor the various parameters that I thought were salient in the operation of this device. Now, for anybody who doesn't know what that is, essentially, you can take a synchronous machine, and by regulating its core excitation, you can make it look electrically like a combination of other ingredients or other electrical apparati, which of course are normally considered distinctly separate entities. For instance, with no excitation in the core, you can give the impression that it's a great big inductor. And once you bring up the excitation about midway, it will appear to be a huge resistor. And if you continue to increase the excitation, it'll look like a huge capacitor is online. So with the mass from the additional generators still in place and properly attended to as far as their torque characteristics are concerned, I could store an enormous amount of energy in this device from the standpoint of the kinetic component. And with a special regulator that I had built, which looked at the droop on the lines and the power factor, I could literally cause this thing to produce an enormous outgoing spike, which would, for all intents and purposes, countermand the inrush from the starting of huge loads, like the conveyors at boat loading, for instance, or when the electric shovels were digging in rock, and there were different loads that were time varying in that respect. And the net result was that when you looked at the recording of this, the demand meters would literally see only about a fifth of the demand that they would normally be able to detect, because I was producing a counter pulse for every starting inrush that the equipment in the quarry generated. And since they use the demand as a multiplier for the monthly bill, naturally the bill was enormously reduced. So I got to be very, very interested in this phenomenon, and when I started to look at the long-term plots or graphs that we were recording of this thing's performance, what I actually noticed, which I thought was pretty cool, was that there was always a positive voltage or positive power spike, followed almost immediately by a negative power spike, approximately the same size. One of them was produced by the starting of a piece of equipment. The other was produced by myself. And so, from my way of thinking, that looked very much to me like an oscillation, even though it was in two separate parts. But you see, the interesting thing is that if you understand how accumulating demand meters work, they only look at the net result. And so the meter doesn't care what piece of equipment is manufacturing the effect. It just goes about metering what it can detect. So as a result of that, I realized that if it was possible to cause a counter movement of power, which was exactly equal to the original inrush, the meter wouldn't see anything. And so what I decided to do was to design some experiments to produce this effect on a continual basis rather than just play around with spikes. And across the river in the village in Detour, they had two great big Fairbanks Moore supposed piston diesels turning 5,000 kW generators, and those two machines were capable of supporting not only the village but also all of the equipment at the quarry, and they were a pretty matched load to the overall capacity of my machine when it was operating in the capacitive mode. The only problem was it would have to be an experiment that was done when the links were down between Detour and the government generating station, which was 65 miles away up in Sault Ste. Marie. And so I had a friend who was the operator in the powerhouse at the time, and I explained to him what I was interested in trying. And he said, well, you know what I'll do? He said, the next time there's a storm, he said, the Great Lakes weather station always sends warning to the various powerhouses. And when I get one of those warnings that they're going to open the links, as soon as I start the diesels, I'll call you. And then you can go over to the island and set up your machine, and we'll try some experiments. Well, he kept his word, and in the meantime, I had prepared equipment that I wanted to use to simulate various electrical phenomena, which normally feed signals into the regulator. And instead of watching the lines for literal changes in power factor and in line droop, I was injecting signals artificially from a variable frequency oscillator and an amplifier. And basically what I wanted to do was to find a parametric resonance frequency that would give me a double power output similar to what I had witnessed on the recording chart when the machine was operating in its normal corrective mode, but I wanted to do it on a continuous basis. So anyway, a big storm came down from the northeast, and we got the notice, and my friend went in and started up his generators. The power company dropped the links to Sault Ste. Marie, and I took the ferry boat over to the island and started up my equipment. And I got a phone call from the guy, told me he was online. And I said, okay, I'll give me a couple of minutes to get situated here, and we'll start the experiment. Well, the interesting thing was that this was just after Thanksgiving and maybe a week or so before Christmas, and it was in that intervening time period, and the decorations were up all over town, and it was in preparation for the holidays, and of course, sleepy little town like that in the middle of an ice storm, nobody's going to expect any unusual activity, but they were about to get some. And I wasn't trying to do anything like this deliberately as far as the effects that it had on the local populace is concerned, but I was dying to learn the secret of the necessary forcing frequency to promote this double power effect that I had witnessed. And so I just took the chance that nothing too bad would happen. And I started off with a very low frequency. I guess it was around 10 or 15 cycles per second. And my friend put some reactive power out on the line, and my equipment immediately noticed that and tried to counter it, but it was doing it at a frequency that was different from the line frequency. And it didn't really start to matter until I got above 60 cycles. And once I got above 60 cycles, that's when we started to notice some incredible beat frequencies and other interesting phenomenon happening. And the charts were recording all this, of course, and the interesting thing was that what I was actually trying to achieve was a form of subharmonic resonance. And as we hit that frequency, all kinds of interesting things happened around the town. A lot of the decorations perished in the surges that were building up on the line, and the jukeboxes were playing at twice their normal speed, and there was all kinds of effects going on with radios and televisions and such and such. But the important thing was that when I hit the exact proper frequency, the whole load disappeared off the generators. And that was what I was looking for. And the only way that that's possible, of course, is if you promote a situation in which power is moving in two directions and being reflected back to the source with just about as much intensity as it was delivered to the load. And when you do this, the situation that's set up is such that the equipment cannot perceive a load, but the electrical activity remains just as vigorous as ever. As a matter of fact, it increases in intensity as it would in any form of resonance. And I remember getting the second phone call from my friend over at the powerhouse who was complaining about the enormous amounts of current that were flying around. And I stepped outside the confines of my little building over there on the island and looked up at the transmission lines. And the transmission lines that left my building and headed on down towards the substation and eventually to the cable crossing were glowing cherry red. And this was at, you know, almost 0 degrees outside in a driving rain in the middle of an ice storm. And that was an extraordinary thing unto itself. Then, of course, what happened was the power that was surging back and forth got to be so enormous that it just blew the cable head, and the whole experiment stopped. But that particular achievement, and it really was an achievement, laid the foundation for me to start to understand what is necessary to produce the Dynaflux effect, which, of course, I worked on the following year. I think I told you about that, too, didn't I, Don?
Yes. Now, was there any investigative journalism about the event, or did it just pass as maybe a normal disruption?
Well, actually, there was no official journalistic investigation or any kind of a write-up about it, because we had a lot of violent storms in that region, and that cable had gone out many times in the past, and I think the assumption was just made that it was struck by lightning. Mm-hmm. But my partner at the time, Mr. Conkle, he wasn't fooled by the whole thing. He came to me the next morning and pretty much told me that it was my doings that had caused all the commotion around the village. And, of course, he was right. The most interesting comment that he made was he was watching Walter Cronkite at the time on TV, and he said that he was totally amazed to see Walter shrink down to the size of a postage stamp and then expand to the point where his nose filled the entire screen.
Oh, to the listening audience, the first time Jim told me, and some of my early radio show listeners, this story, I laughed 15 or 20 minutes. I mean, it's on an archive. I've heard this before, and it's still funny. And I'm sure there are some people out there laughing.
There might be some people out there crying, too, so I don't want to get into all the details.
Well, yeah.
There were a lot of unwholesome side effects, but I think that the real important issue is that to achieve that type of an effect with, 10,000 kW worth of electrical power is more than just an item of passing interest. And, of course, the thing that I have endeavored to do in the years succeeding that event is to produce this effect under controlled circumstances and with custom-built equipment, so that it can not only be investigated more thoroughly, but also eventually will evolve into a worthwhile product. And that's exactly what I've been doing.
Yes. I would presume with proper adjustments for the types of materials that we have today and the methods, that could that's something that could be built and very reliably, could it not, to power cities around the world?
Well, there's no reason why it would be any more complicated to build in any size than a normal generating device, because it uses all the same type of materials and copper wire and all the normal things. It's just that the physical arrangement in that particular kind of an embodiment is totally different.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it subscribes to all the laws of physics. There's nothing about it that's really that mysterious. I mean, when you stop and think of it, the biggest mistake that's being made right now, which prevents people from taking a really big leap to another level of understanding, is that they insist upon essentially throwing power away on every cycle. And so as a result of that, the line is forced to deliver a continuous flow of kilowatts that move from the source to the load. And all that I basically have been advocating is that, and actually Tesla mentions this long before I was around. He mentions it in some of his European lectures, where he talks about the fact that the next generation or the next plateau of understanding with regard to electrical power will only come into place when people realize that it's the power that needs to be oscillated, not just the current and the voltage. And so this puts the whole thing, the whole game, as it were, into a higher octave or a higher expression than ordinary AC. Because in ordinary AC, what you actually have is you have a time-varying voltage and a time-varying current, which are essentially sinusoids. But the product of those two, especially if the load is resistive, is a waveform that literally sits on the x-axis, has no negative going components to it, but for all intents and purposes, it represents the same type of power that you would see from a pulsating source of DC. Now, when you go to the next level of expression, it does have a negative going component, and as a result of that, it tends towards an average value of zero as far as the device that's producing it is concerned, but it does not tend towards zero as far as the device that's consuming it is concerned. And that's where the interesting stuff comes into play, because normally in so-called linear power systems, the relationship between the applied power and the consumed power is not only linear, but it's very predictable, so that V times I is almost always equal to I squared R. And I say almost always because there are variations on certain types of waveforms. But in the arrangement that I'm talking about, the relationship between those parameters is actually represented by an inequality. And that's what blows people's minds, because they're still so used to thinking about power flowing only in one direction that when you introduce a system where you have bidirectional power flow, you get these incredible differences between the watt meter that's at the load and the watt meter that's at the supply side. And it's not uncommon to see 600%, 1,000% more power being consumed than what's registering from the source. And people immediately assume you're creating energy, which is a lot of hogwash. But that's the pivotal point of the entire argument, is that that's how power should be looked upon, and that's how it should be manufactured and utilized, and then you would definitely see a completely different, what you might call the appearance of a hyper-efficiency in the operation of electrical equipment.
Yes, and in light of the current cap-and-trade push to introduce windmill turbine generated power, which is right now, as I understand it, it's no larger than 3% of all the power that we consume. That's really not a practical way to produce electricity, is it? On according to the current demands for it.
Well, let's put it this way. I have all kinds of respect for any source of electrical power, and a lot of ingenious concepts have been made use of to tap into all of nature's forces, you know, whether they be windmills or water wheels or geothermal sources. It doesn't make any difference. But as you pointed out, the real issue is that wind power represents such a tiny portion of what's consumed in the nation today on the grid, or I should say from the grid, that I think its presence is basically inconsequential. And quite frankly, I look upon it as a political ploy more so than any kind of a practical solution.
Yeah.
The same is actually true of solar power, because in the small quantities that it's used and all of the complexity associated with producing it, and the cost per kilowatt and all the other factors added in, and the lack of reliability, I might add, of the sun as a continuous source of constant power, just make those two possibilities impractical, in my opinion.
Yeah, especially with chemtrails.
Yeah.
Well, so you basically completed your work in Michigan, and then what inspiration did you have at that point, Jim?
Well, it wasn't so much an inspiration, to be honest with you, at that point. It was more a determination. When I was in Michigan and was playing around with this synchronous capacitor project on the island, the things that I learned from doing that were the basis or the foundation for my own concept of developing a miniature generation device which would act the same as that whole power system behaved under those circumstances that I described. And that became the Dynaflux alternator. And the reason I left Michigan at that point, quite frankly, was because I was interested in promoting this concept and doing something with it. And having been raised in the East, and I had a lot of connections there, I figured the intelligent thing to do was to go back to my native land, so to speak, and start communing with money people. And of course, when I did that, that's when I really ran into a lot of not only resistance, but a lot of information that let's just say that the average person would never get wind of. And one of the things, of course, that happened too as a result of that was I was introduced to some really unusual individuals. One of them was a guy who had been one of the founders of IBM. And he invited me out to his home in Long Island, where he's living at the time. And we spent a whole day together discussing the power problem and the Dynaflux concept and, you know, the wealth of IBM and all these types of things. And he told me in no uncertain terms that he would not be allowed to put any money into anything I was doing as long as it was achieved with a rotating component. And he said the basic charter that had IBM's, that had say-so in IBM's investment policies, basically precluded anything electromagnetic. But what he did say, which I thought was really cool, and I was always grateful that I had met the guy just for this one sentence. He said to me, however, he said, if you can produce the same effect with a solid-state device that is orchestrated by a microprocessor, he said, that will be another story. He said, that will just literally open the floodgates, and I'll be able to make a sizable investment in what you're trying to achieve. Well, it turned out to be a really worthwhile thought, because I had been concentrating on producing energy resonance from the point of view of the generating apparatus. I had never really given any thought to the possibility that the same effect might be produced on the receiving side. And so I started to really dig into that as a result of this gentleman's prompting. And unfortunately, it took another 6 years of experimentation and study for me to understand how the reverse procedure was possible. But I ultimately did solve that problem. The only problem was that by that time the guy had passed away, so that didn't work out too well. But the technology still exists, and I can assure you that it can be done with a solid-state approach as well as with a rotational approach, and basically makes use of the same principles. Now, somewhere else along the line, another thing that cropped up, which was interesting, and that was that a lot of people wanted to see the differential equations for all this stuff. Well, you know, it's very, very difficult to sit down and derive the proper equations to describe all these things for a number of different reasons, but mostly because they're discontinuous functions, and they have to be explained with sometimes with two or three or four separate equations, which relate to different aspects of what's happening. And solving these equations turned out to be an absolute nightmare. The differential equations themselves and the nonlinear forcing functions were bad enough, but the fact is that they also necessitated that you had to solve for various constants. And when it turned out that the constants became necessary to discover their value by the solution of some pretty sophisticated matrices. And so it just became the kind of nightmare that was only going to be possible with the help of a mathematician and some pretty sophisticated computer modeling software, none of which I could afford. So what I did instead, which turned out to be a really worthwhile move, I gave some serious thought to the entire process, and I said to myself, well, look, if this truly represents something that is completely acceptable to nature, then it's going to show up in other forms, or it should show up in other forms. And so I started to investigate the possibility of creating energy resonance systems in very, very simplistic mechanical forms. And that's when I really started to understand, you know, what was going on. Because to solve those equations, you didn't need a computer, but what you did need was a completely different point of view on the way conservation of energy is utilized in various problems in mechanics. And it turns out that when you utilize conservation of energy exclusively to solve certain problems in mechanics, it literally masks, the use of that approach literally masks the very thing that you're looking for. And so what I discovered, which eventually brought me to the mechanical solution, is that there are certain ways to manipulate forces in relatively simple, everyday circumstances that bring you to the same place mechanically that I wound up electrically, and that is that the work done on the system by whatever force you're using is not related to the energy by an equality, but rather by an inequality. And and that kind of thing is really where the answer is to all this stuff.
Yeah. Jim, excuse me. What you're describing implies that there might be another math system to be developed. To do that, of course, you'd have to understand how you would go about differentiating what traditional math, trigonometry, algebra, geometry, whatever you're going to incorporate into it, calculus, and all the different computational tools that we use currently might have to be discarded totally.
I disagree with that. I think it's just the other way around. To be honest with you, I think that back in the time when Steinmetz was hired to basically debug Tesla's statements concerning the possibilities of these other types of energy expressions, that was just around the same time when they started changing the curriculum requirements for electrical engineers and engineers in general. And if you study engineering today, you'll have to study all the normal stuff, the algebra, the trig, the calculus, and the differential equations. And if you stick in there long enough, you probably go to, some higher order forms of math that involve all kinds of things, including statistics. But the real interesting thing is this. Nature doesn't have any limitations on the way it expresses herself. And the interesting thing is we have in our school systems, colleges and what have you, done away with the most natural form of trigonometry. And the trig we study now is basically circular trig, or the trigonometry of circles. But a circle is a special case. And the real original trigonometry that used to be taught to engineers was elliptical trig, which was based on the study of the ellipse. Now, when the two foci of an ellipse overlap one another, then you have a circle. So that's fine because it shows the way that the two systems blend together. But by studying circular trigonometry only, the problem is that we are only studying a very limited and special case of trig. And all of the magical things that happen throughout the universe are not based on circles. They're based on elliptical motion. And the same holds true, I might add, for electrical and mechanical phenomenon. So I think that just by eliminating elliptical trigonometry from school curriculums and adjusting various aspects of calculus and a few little minor points of view in physics, you can literally brainwash people into never looking in the right place to see all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I guarantee you that somebody somewhere made those arrangements.
Well, then you're implying that current mathematical systems are up to snuff in terms of having the potential to solve any equation or any problem. I want to make a comparison to something. If I can read something that I read on the show last night, and this is describing how spaceships move from one point to another at incredible speeds. I think you'll find this interesting, because I think there's an analogy here with this description, and in a sense, the phenomenon that you're describing with your Dynaflux generator, or for that matter, the concept of a synchronous capacitor. This is a quote in the middle of answering a few questions about dimensions and how the ships move. And this is in relation to the United Galactic Federation, Galaxy of Hendon. This is a quote from General Jeremiah. "When we reach hyperspace speed, we bend time and reach a destination in a short period, which would normally take many light years to accomplish. We do not change dimensions. When antimatter is created by the generators on our spacecraft, it produces a warp in time. We also use portals that some call stargates. When we obtain hyperspace speed inside a portal, which is a passageway in space from one point to another, we can traverse light years of distance in very short periods. These portals are frequencies. Our spacecraft have the ability to lock onto these portal frequencies to enter them. All of them are different. There are no preset frequency codes because the frequencies of these portals are constantly changing. Our computers are able to ascertain the frequency as we approach a portal. We have millions of them mapped in space and know approximately where a portal starts and ends. We ride in that tunnel until we get close to our destination, and then we depart it and travel the remainder of the distance to our destination via antimatter propulsion systems combined with anti-gravity propulsion. Once we are in the troposphere of the planet, moon, etc., that we desire. The first time I traveled to another planet, I felt like my mind and body were separating." Then he goes on to describe, "Fortunately, I had Karen with me, with her arms around my waist, talking to me. The next trip was not that way. My mind had become attuned to the frequency change. The first trip was to Karen's home planet to meet and visit her family. What an awesome experience, and what a beautiful planet and beautiful people. I can now pilot the spacecraft myself and accomplish such a flight. The 12 light years to her planet only took about 2.5 hours to accomplish. Most of that was in transitioning from the portal to normal spaceflight." Now, do we have science that that can explain that? I think to an extent we do, because we do have craft that use those portals going to the moon or to the, Mars. It's more critical going to Mars via a portal because of the distance. Any comment you want to make?
Well, I have to be honest with you. You know, my particular experience, of course, doesn't include that knowledge, although I've certainly read about it and I know that it's out there. But I will tell you this. The interesting thing about coming to an understanding about the way all these planetary constituents actually operate, I think also involves a shift in consciousness. And I'll give you a very quick and easy way to understand what I mean by that.
Sure.
Well, when we are in grade school and we are given our first science book, they show you a picture of the solar system as if it was actually occupying a single plane. You see the sun in the middle, and then you see the various orbits going around the sun, as they spread out towards the outer planets. And of course, they're all different sizes and different distances from our central star. But in reality, there's no way that can be right. Because if you stop and think about it, our sun is moving through space in our galaxy, the Milky Way, at an enormous rate of speed. And it is literally dragging its planetary group with it. And so in reality, what you have is a situation where the planets are not all in a single equatorial plane of the sun, as they like to be depicted. But in reality, they are falling behind the sun to various degrees while still maintaining so-called elliptical orbits. But the problem is that due to their inertial characteristics as well as their angular momentum, what they really are forming are open spirals, because it's impossible, if the sun is never in the same place, it's impossible for a planet that's orbiting the sun to make an ellipse or a circle. It winds up making an open spiral as it follows the path of the sun. And so each of our planetary constituents are also making these open spirals, and the entire effect is a huge vortexian type of motion, you know, that fills space. Now, I can tell you that I've done a little bit of tinkering around with some of the mathematics that is implied by these things. And there are some really simple truths that a person can investigate without a whole lot of mathematical rigor involved. One of them comes with the realization, for instance, that a vortex or a whirlpool, if you want to look at it that way, is essentially the mathematical inverse of a wheel. The motion of a wheel is such that there's basically no movement at the very, very geometric center of the hub. That one infinitesimal point that represents the true geometric center of a wheel, hardly undergoes any motion at all. But the farther you travel out the wheel, along one of its spokes, let's say, toward the rim, at any given speed of angular rotation, you wind up having larger and larger values of tangential velocity associated with your progression along a given radius. Now, the interesting thing is the vortex is just the opposite. The farther out you go on the vortex, the closer you approach a stationary field that just, it's like a tensor field with a slight bend to it. But as you start to approach the center of the vortex, the velocity increases until at the very center, it's at its maximum angular displacement per unit time. And so the trick is to understand what is the difference between the two geometries. And I don't know if I'm giving away the store here or not, but I'll tell you this quite openly, that if you take the standard equation for a circle and literally divide it into one, you will get the most, and then plot the results, you'll get the most amazing and very illuminating answer in terms of the graphics that are produced. And rather than me tell you what that is, I think it would be interesting for people to try it and maybe call in at another show and say what they've learned. But I can tell you this much. I know that it's related to the principles that your friend General Jeremiah is talking about.
Yes, this is sort of why I mentioned this. Now, he's discussing some things that imply that there's a grid, not just millions of these frequencies, which are portals, or portals that emanate a frequency, but that the frequency changes, and their computers are so advanced that they can determine what that frequency is at any given moment. And if you're going to be moving light years in 2.5 hours, I think you want to be pretty accurate with that. So imagine the technology they have. You see, that's disclosure.
Oh, yeah, I can understand exactly what you mean.
Yeah, this is part of what disclosure should be about. It's telling us the truth and the truth about the real nature of the universe and how it impacts the Earth. Now, if these vortices or portals are found through space from one place to another, then certainly we have to have them here on Earth. And I've talked about that. You've talked about that as well. It's confirmation that this is universal science here. And despite what they try to obfuscate, fact is that they're traveling at these great distances at incredible speeds. And they're moving their minds and their bodies at those speeds. What do you think that is? Mach 100 to the 100th power?
I don't know what Mach would be, but I can tell you one thing. I think that this is a good place where you can start to interject Star Wars talk. I mean, or not Star Wars, but Star Trek. I mean, you're talking warp, you know, warp factors here. You know.
Yes. Yes.
So when you start going faster than the speed of light by, significant digits, you're moving right along. There's no two ways about that.
Yeah. And, now, just as a comparison, this level of science and technology and physics and everything that goes with it, the mathematics, everything, is possible, then what you're talking about doing with electricity is quite simple, isn't it? And yet you have a cabal that does everything they can to prevent that from being utilized by the masses.
Well, I tell you what, it's simple once you understand it, but I'll tell you where the biggest point of control is on all of this. And that is that 99.9% of the people who even get some form of inspiration to go in that direction are basically meeting so much resistance of so many different kinds that they just give up. You know, the first thing that they meet up with, of course, is that the standard teachings don't include that type of philosophy, and so right away they are given negative suggestions not to proceed. If they're stubborn and decide to go ahead anyway, the next thing that they run into is there are no facts in any books, or very, very few, at least in the modern books, that support any kind of approach of that nature. Then the third thing is that you have to be pretty darn well-founded in terms of designing experiments and utilizing instruments to see some of the effects that lead you in this direction. You also have to know a fair amount of mathematics, or at least have the ability to avail yourself of mathematical aid in making these various tests and experiments. And, of course, the fifth and probably the most difficult thing to overcome is money. And that's, if all else fails, that's where they get you by the short hairs. It's because of the money. They certainly control most of the sources of money. You know, the only way you can get around some of that is if you're lucky enough to have a private benefactor who says, yeah, I'm wealthy, let's just play and see what you come up with. I was lucky enough to have two or three of them in my lifetime. The rest I did on my own.
Yeah. Well, you also described a demonstration that you had given I guess it was an associate that was entrusted to give his thumbs up advice regarding witnessing your Dynaflux generator, and you had mentioned, and now this was a year or two ago that we first spoke about this, you had mentioned that your 18 years had passed and you're still waiting for his reply. in that regard.
I think right now it's longer than 18
years. Yeah, so at least 20 years now, huh? You're still waiting for that report.
Well, what happened with that was pretty interesting. I was given a grant, which blew my socks off. I never really expected to get it in the first place, but it was, I think it was a $25,000 grant, and it was issued by a very prominent organization that has its headquarters in Philadelphia. We'll leave it at that.
Okay.
And one of the conditions of getting this grant and using it to produce a larger prototype of the generator, which is what I used it for, was that the entire project had to be overseen by a very prominent electrical engineer, and that individual would be picked by the grant committee. And so I submitted to that. I didn't care. And the guy turned out to be a really nice individual. He was very brilliant. He held a very prestigious position with one of the largest engineering schools in Pennsylvania, and he was very excited about the project, to be honest with you. Now, I have to admit that by this time, I knew enough not to come right out and tell him what the true objective was. So we very casually disguised what we were doing by simply saying that it was a completely new type of embodiment for an alternator, which, of course, it was. And so he more or less participated in various aspects of the design and watched it being built. We had a machine shop at the time in Pennsylvania where we were making the parts. And he seemed to be right on board. It was kind of exciting. And then when we actually came to the point of testing the final device, that's where he stepped in officially. He brought his own equipment with him, his own instrumentation. Everything was calibrated. Everything was traceable back to NBS standards, the whole nine yards. And we proceeded to use a calibrated power resistance box, you know, as our load source, and started off with high-end resistors and worked our way down, you know, to very low values of resistance, and everything was fully instrumented. So he took it upon himself to orchestrate the test. He made all the recordings of the values and the numbers for calculations, and he also had a little miniature calculator that was like built into his clipboard, so that every once in a while he could run numbers right there. And he did that. And then he scribbled the results in the margins, you know, as we were proceeding. And when we were about two-thirds of the way through, he suddenly turned to me and he said, "You know that this machine of yours puts out more power than it consumes." And mind you, this was like, you know, 18 months after we started into this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, "Yeah, I know. That's why you're here." says he. "But that's totally impossible. So therefore, it must be doing something else." And those were his exact words. So I said, "Okay, well, what's it doing then?" And he said, "Well, I have to get back to you on that." And I'm still waiting.
20 years. Well, Jim, we're almost out of time. I think we should continue this discussion next week if that's to your liking, because I know that you have a lot more to share. And, you know, I may have taken us off course in a sense, but I wanted to just emphasize the point that there are sciences out there that we don't completely understand. If we did, we would have a much higher consciousness. And we're at a critical time in the world's history, and certainly our nation's history, where we have this election, a major election coming up, where we have to clean house and get rid of the criminals. There's no doubt about it. And they even control the voting machines. But we have within us the power to pray and to visualize and to will another reality, another outcome. And it doesn't take bullets, and it doesn't take war, and it doesn't require death to do that. And I wanted to conclude tonight's show with a song before we actually part. So stay with us if you would.
All right.
Ognuno di una sola vicina.
That's Andrea Bocelli, accompanied by Celine Dion. If you do anything over this weekend, ladies and gentlemen, in preparing for this important election coming up in the month of November, please take time to pray. Jim, any closing comments you want to make tonight?
Well, actually, I will only restate something you said a few minutes before playing the song, and that is that the power to make changes is definitely within us. And, you know, those types of changes that we're hoping to see will not come about on their own. It definitely takes some intestinal fortitude and some determination in order to make things happen. And it's no different to achieve that type of a goal than it is to achieve any other. If you don't believe it can be done, it's only because you have some type of mental resistance to the idea. But it's never too late to make changes, and it will be easier for us to make them now than it will be if the New World Order ever does succeed. I assure you of that.
Well, Jim, it's been a fantastic show, very enlightening, very educational, and even a bit entertaining when you described Walter Cronkite shrinking to the size of a postage stamp. I want to thank you for your contribution to the show, and I look forward to your interview next Friday with us. You have a great weekend, my friend.
Thank you. Same to you, Doug.
Thank you. Folks, that wraps it up. You've been listening to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com, and tonight's special guest, scientist, inventor, Jim Murray. Also want to thank Windtalkers Radio Network for broadcasting the show over at BBS Radio, Seth Hendrick on the sound. Want to thank Don and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible, and most of all, you, the listening audience, for tuning in. Have a great weekend. Come back and listen to Monday night's show when my special guest will be Dr. H. Huat. In the meantime, I wish everyone a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night. We'll be right back.